just yell out where you're from, I'll try to hear. That was a good experiment. I'll never try that again. but I heard New York. I heard New York. That part I got. All right. So I didn't grow up religious. I grew up in a reform background, but with a real strong sense of Judaism, very strong Jewish identity, but no real concept of observance, really. Bless you. I remember when I was six or something like that. Someone told me when you burp, you have to say excuse me. So I remember that night I was alone we had this really big kitchen, giant pink kitchen, and I was sitting alone like a little boy at the table, and I burped, and I thought, no one's in the room, do I say excuse me? And then I thought, God is here, so I better say excuse me. You know, so even as a kid, I had a sense of that God was a very present thing, that God wasn't like an abstract notion, that God's real, you know? You know, one of the things that I'm very focused on is that for so many people, God is an abstraction. Like, they say like this, okay, here are things that are in the world. There's concrete, and there's football, and there's math, and there are thimbles, and there are pencils, and there's God, and there's baseball, and there's string. Wait a second, did you, like number seven on that list, what was that? God is not something that's on a list of things that are in this world. This whole world is inside God. And then God goes beyond this world. Okay, so that's one of the things when we say, Kadosh, 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 Hashem Sfakot, Melo Kol Ha'aretz Kavodo, that means the entire world is saturated with godliness. I was talking to someone one time. I said, where's your car parked? He says, across the street. I said, do you realize you can't get to your car without swimming through godliness? You know, I once imagined a conversation between two fish, right? One fish says to the other fish, do you believe in water? And the other fish says, I don't know. My grandfather was very religious. He believed in water. Right? It's crazy. Meanwhile, well, you know the rest of that thought. We say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. What does Echad mean? Right? It's everywhere. Tell you a Torah that changed my life. Hashem, it's just a few parshas ago. Hashem is talking to Avraham Avinu after the bris, and then Avraham Avinu like runs to give hospitality. You all know the story. So all the rabbis are going, what? How can it be that Avraham Avinu is interrupting God? A lot of big people ask that question. So the way it was taught to me was, Chas v'shalom, in a million billion years, you should think that Avraham Avinu was interrupting God. He was deepening the conversation with God by doing a mitzvah, by bringing God into this world through the mitzvah of Hachnasas Orachim. That's our whole life. Everything we're doing is an ongoing conversation with God. Everything. It's all it is. Every single thing. So I had an older brother, and I lived in a big building on 79th Street and Broadway. I also grew up in New York, on the Upper West Side, if you know it at all. And there was one religious person in the entire building, okay? And she gives my older brother a subscription to Talks and Tales, which was the Lubavitcher Children's Magazine. I'm sure he wasn't so thrilled, you know, it's like, what? And back then, it was like, it was incredibly low tech. I mean, you know, it was like, someone was running it off in their back room or something like that. You know, there was like a nature page with like a black and white, somewhat out of focus picture of an owl. You know what I mean? I mean, just imagine the words low tech. This was the essence of low tech. But I got to tell you, this magazine absolutely changed my life. Changed my life. Because there was one page, I was reading them. There was one page that had Hasidic stories. And every Hasidic story was more or less the same thing. It was about how Hashem was intimately involved in your life. And my whole Torah education was basically coming from this magazine. I was like, okay, there's a God, and he cares, and he's there, and he loves you. Okay, I'm ready to go. What's next, you know? So what can I tell you? I'll get to the big sort of official turning point in my life. I was out in Hollywood, and I was writing, there were at that point 99 shows. I was 24 at this time. There was a lot that takes place beforehand, but let's just get to it. There was 99 shows on the air at that time, in prime time, and I had just gotten a job on the 99th rated show. It was literally the bottom rated show on television. Probably for good reason it was called Women in Prison. It was a comedy. One of the early comedies on Fox. Before The Simpsons even. And no one was watching it. And I remember I'd go into the office and I'd say, hey, well, how did we do this week? And the assistant would say, we're 97. And I was like, no, you don't understand. If you're going to be down that low, you know, you might as well be 99th, you know, because there are no bragging rights to being 97th, you know? So, I got that job. It was August. Shabbos comes in late. I just started keeping Shabbos for a few months already. Why? I should probably tell you why. Because life was great. That's why. Life was fantastic. And I felt so appreciative to God. I said to myself, how can I say thank you back to God? And I thought, for some reason, don't ask me why, I thought if I keep Shabbos, that will be my way of saying thank you back to God. And also, I'll tell you something else. This was a Torah that I had heard in the name of the Ishbitzer Rebbe, but years later I found out that it was actually said by someone in drug rehab with tattoos up and down his arms, who is a biker, no less. And I'll tell you, it didn't change my appreciation for this Torah at all. In fact, it made me love this Torah even more. So it goes like this. He said that that the way Hashem makes us all, there's a God-shaped hole inside of every single person. God makes us that way, with a God-shaped hole. And all of us feel it. All of us feel there's something missing. And depending on how much we know, we try to fill it with different things, with drugs or with sex or with money or with relationships or, you know, career accomplishments. But it's like if you've ever done a jigsaw puzzle and there's a piece missing and you try to jam the wrong piece in, it doesn't fit. Nothing fills the God-shaped hole except God. That's the way God made us. So I was also feeling that, like I had a lot of stuff, everything was going right, you know, parties, friends, everything was good. But, you know, anyway, so the first the first week comes, and we break early because, you know, when a show starts up, there's not all that much to do. So I get home in time for Shabbos. I hadn't mentioned the fact that I kept Shabbos to my bosses. I'd only been doing it for a few months, and I didn't know you were supposed to do that. So, naivete. Second week comes around, and we've got a little bit more to do. And I lived close to the studio, and I still remember it very clearly. I'm sitting in front of a big picture window, palm trees. It's Friday. The sun is setting literally in front of my eyes. And it's one of these meetings, if you haven't been in one of them yet, any of you go into the business world, you'll know what these meetings are like. where they're just about to end, and then someone says, oh, and one more thing. And you want to throttle them, you know? So I'm sitting there getting, like, kind of anxious because I've got to go. And I haven't mentioned anything about Shabbos. And there's, you know, like, the staff is there. That wasn't the time for, like, a whole thing, you know? Hey, you guys have heard of Shabbos, right? No? Anyone got a chumash here? That's the five books. Okay, let's start there. You know, like, what am I supposed to say in, like, 2 minutes, right? So I didn't know what to do, so I just stood up and I walked out of the room. And years later, it occurred to me that I'm sure everyone thought I was going to the bathroom. But I didn't come back, you know? And I ran to my car, and I thought, wow, this is giving me a lot of anxiety. Got home in time, thank God. I tell you, it reminds me of a story. I don't know if you're familiar with Rabbi Mordechai Becher. Big rabbi in the circuit. And I heard him say this, so he said that he was giving some sort of Shabbos program in Hong Kong, and they put him up on, like, the 75th floor. And he was at some point, he's walking, going up the service stairwell, you know, he's got to get to his room. He's like on, like, the 72nd floor, and one of the Asian workers comes out and, like, looks at him, and it's very clear what's going on. And he looks back at him and he says, it's my day of rest. You know? So, you know, I was thinking, you know, I can't do this every single week. This is, I gotta just talk to my bosses, explain to them what's going on, and, you know, it'll be cool. So, anyway, I had a partner at the time who I'd been doing all my writing with since Harvard. I was on the Harvard Lampoon, the humor magazine there. And so all my professional work had been with this person. And I said to him, you know, I'm going to ask them if I can get a few hours off, just, you know, so I can keep Shabbos. And it was a Jew and a non-Jew, and both very good people. And this was their first show that they had gotten on the air, so this was a big thing for them, and it was just starting up. And I said to them, would it be okay if I left a few hours early so that I can observe the Sabbath? And they looked at me and they said, no, you can't. And had we known that, we never would have hired you to begin with. And then, actually, the non-Jewish woman said to the Jewish man, very seriously, we're going to burn in hell for this. You know? I never actually heard anyone say that seriously. You know? So I went home and I called my agent and he said, so what are you going to do? I said, what do you mean what am I going to do? I'm not going to work on Shabbos. He said, well then you're never going to work in television again. And you know, I don't know if you guys are fans of old movies, but, like, one of the kind of staples of old movies, one of the cliches is, you'll never work in this town again. And I thought, wow, someone's actually saying that. And they're saying it to me. I was like, cool, say it again. So he said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know, I'll write movies. He said, you don't just write movies. And I hadn't really realized it at the time, but the Hollywood is actually very segregated, for want of a better word. You've got television, and you've got movies, and you've got comedy, and you've got drama, and you've got late night, and you've got soap operas, and they're all, for all practical business purposes, separate worlds, you know? So he came in the next day with his with this other agent, and it was kind of funny because this is going back a ways. This is like 20 years ago, and even 20 years ago, no one actually used briefcases anymore. But I've got a clear memory of the two of them walking down the aisle with great purpose carrying briefcases, and I had no idea where they got them from, you know? Like from the props department or something, you know? So they're there, and I'm talking to my partner at that time, and I said to him, listen, you know, I feel very uncomfortable right now. Because, you know, we had gotten hired due to a script that we had co-written together. So he wouldn't have gotten the job without me. And yet, right now, it would appear that he's going to be fired because of me. And that's not right. That doesn't work. And, you know, I explained to him that this is something that I had to do. And I explained to him that there's more to life than chasing a buck. I think that's an exact quote. I think I said that to him. And I said, but if you want to try to stay on the show without me, and I had done all of my professional work with him, even pre-professional, like discovering about comedy writing and all the rest, just about all of that had been with him. And I said, if you want to try to stay on the show without me, and I understand. And I said, and if they don't let you, because I had been a little more vocal, you know, during the first couple of weeks, so they liked me, they were probably had a little bit more of a question mark about him. I said, if you try to stay on without me and they don't let you, then I want you to know I'm not going to hold it against you. I'll still write with you. And I said, and if you do try to stay on the show without me and they do let you and down the line you want to write together, I'll never hold it against you. And he said to me, well, I think that I would like to try to stay on the show without you. And I was like, what? You know, I actually didn't say that. He said, because I think I'd always wonder what would have happened to my career. And you know what? He wasn't Jewish, and he's an excellent guy, was supportive through and through. So what can I say? That's fair. And I respect that. And so at this point, basically, I was losing my job. I was told that I wasn't going to work in television again. And I was losing my partner that I had done all my professional work with. So you might think that I was freaking out at this point. And the reality is that I wasn't. I was very calm. Because it was clear to me that nothing bad was going to happen from keeping Shabbos. I might lose my job. I might have to change careers. But nothing bad is going to happen from keeping Shabbos. Absolutely not. That's just not the case. So, as it turned out, my agents came in and they made an arrangement where I could continue to stay on the show. They wanted to make room in the budget to bring on another writer because the truth is Friday night was a big writing night, in truth, it really was. And they wanted to have that extra support there. So they gave us a slightly lower salary, but we had come in at a slightly inflated salary, and a slightly lower title, but we had come in at a slightly inflated title. And so it worked out. What can I tell you? My life has never been the same after that. You know, I mentioned that I went to Harvard. That had been a big goal of mine growing up. I've won an Emmy Award. I've won a Golden Globe Award. I've worked on some of the really the top shows of the last couple of decades, classic shows. And the reason why I tell you that is because this story that I just told you is the proudest moment of my entire life. My whole life, this is the proudest moment. You know, We're so lucky to be alive, and we're so lucky to be in this world. When I had my first kid, we had him in L.A. at Cedar Sinai Hospital, and I don't know if it's still there, but outside the window of like where you give birth was the Hard Rock Cafe. And over the Hard Rock Cafe at that point, there was a sign that had the world's population. And one of those rolling number signs, you know what I mean, that like never stops. And I was, you know, like any first-time dad, right, making a movie, you know, whatever. Here's my wife screaming in pain. Actually, I wouldn't have filmed that. But you know, I was just trying to, whatever, being what I thought a father is supposed to be doing at that point, you know. And I looked out the window, and I've never actually seen this on tape, but I remember filming this. And I remember looking out the window, kind of just getting the view, and realizing that my first child is about to be born, and here's the world population sign, you know? Like, my son is going to be one of the numbers on that sign. And I thought more, and I realized, you know, it says in Gomorrah Sanhedrin, when's Mashiach going to come? So there's a lot of different answers that are given. But one of the answers is that when all of the neshamas that are supposed to be born, when all the neshamas come down from heaven, when they all come down from heaven, then that's going to be it. So I thought, you know, there's a finite number of souls. There's a finite number of people who are going to be born, based on that anyway. So I thought, wow, you know, it's no small thing to be alive. It's no small thing to be born. And then I started thinking about it a little bit more. And I thought, you know something? Have you ever, I'm sure everyone's had this experience. I know I've had it more than once. Have you ever wanted to really go to a party, but it's like by invitation only? And it's like, yeah. Listen, you're speaking for all of us. You're speaking for all of us. And it's like, man, it would be, I wish I would, oh, that's going to be such a good party. And all the people who I would like to think like have been invited. So it would be nice if I were also invited, you know. So can you imagine, like, what if God is giving that party? What if God is giving that party? You know? So that is kind of happening. It's kind of happening right now. And if you're born, that means God himself puts you on the guest list. So you rank. You rank in a serious way. You know? You know? There's more that I want to talk about, but the truth is I kind of maybe want to take some questions right now if anyone's got anything in mind. And like I say, you can ask about anything. I'll try to answer. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I just actually finished a new show. I created the show for Comedy Central. It's called The Root of All Evil with Lewis Black. I don't know if any of you guys know who that is.
Yes.
But the idea was, I had this idea to put American popular culture on trial and to try to find out what the most evil things in society are. And so basically, it's kind of like a mock courtroom kind of thing where you've got two things. Like, for instance, one show we did was Disney versus Scientology, right? Or Paris Hilton versus Dick Cheney. Or beer versus weed, you know? Like, we try to figure out, like, which one is the worst of the two? And it was good for me because it was an opportunity to sort of like be very funny and topical, but also really kind of like, you know, like with a critical eye examine the false idols that society is erecting, you know? Yeah, go ahead.
How do you balance Judaism and like thoughts of Judaism about some of the shows that you do? Like sometimes it might be conflicting, you know, thoughts and ideas.
Yeah, so one thing is that I haven't really written for any shows. Hashem has been very kind and hasn't really tested me in this way. But I've never I really wouldn't write for a very violent show or a very sexual show. You know, I really try to stay away from that. Just try to do stuff that's more just entertaining and light and stuff like that. You know, which I think has a purpose in society. I think people need to be cheered up and stuff. And actually, this last show that I did was probably the most off-color. I didn't write that stuff. We'd come up with the arguments against various false idols, if you will, in society. And then these stand-up comics would kind of write their material, their arguments supporting the case. And some of the stuff was definitely more blue, as we say in the industry, than I would have liked. But I thought to myself, you know, if you're trying to talk to someone in who's in a bar, you speak the language of the bar. So, and then also I edited the shows. So anything that was really momish, like, I just took out. You know what I mean? So that's kind of how I dealt with it. You know? Yeah, go ahead.
Have your coworkers responded to your being Jewish on the news?
How my what?
Coworkers.
Very respectful. Very, very respectful. And I'll tell you something. You know, understandably, a lot of us tend to be self-conscious when we're around non-Jews or Jews who aren't observant, and think that the best way to sort of like advance our cause is to sort of hide our observance. And the reality is that there's so few people today who stand for anything. When they meet someone who actually stands for something and who's actually thought through what it means to be alive in this world, or why there's a world, or what we're supposed to be doing, they're very respectful. They're very, very respectful, consistently, Jews and non-Jews. And my rule is, at work, is that I don't initiate any conversations about Torah. But I don't think I've been on a show where I haven't had tons of them. I wait for someone to ask me a question. So when I see that there's an interest, or when I see that there's a need, then I address that. And that way there's sort of like a vessel. Do you know what I'm saying? And then people receive it. And, you know, Kanai Nohara, it's been an amazing thing. You know, a couple people that I've worked with are actually learning right now, full-time in Yeshiva in Yerushalayim, you know? And it's just kind of... You'd be amazed at the level of hunger, things that you guys take for granted and whatever, are giant chidushim to people who haven't been exposed to these ideas. And there's a tremendous hunger for it. Tremendous hunger. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you remember how much I work at that?
You know, I have, but I prefer to wear a baseball cap. And it's just more low-key. And I'm a little more under the radar, and I like it that way. But, you know, in terms of kashrus, in terms of Shabbos, in terms of all of the halachas, I'm very machmer. But in that way, I just feel like it's just like a little smoother, you know? Yeah.
Do you think there's a room to publicize God within this framework, this medium?
Yeah, you know, a lot of hit shows, like Touched by an Angel, is the first thing that comes to mind. But there have been actually a lot of hit shows about God on television. Mostly in drama, not really in comedy. But yeah. Yeah. You know, like, the answer is no. You know, someone asked me, I actually spoke at Reishi. Do you know that place? I was speaking there today, you know? So someone came up to me afterwards, you know, it was just kind of one-on-one. And he said to me, like, you know, if the whole world is filled with God, why aren't you putting more God on the shows you work on? So... First of all, I appreciated the fact that he asked me that in private. Gave me time to come up with an answer. So now I'm volunteering his question, and I'll tell you the answer I gave him. I said, imagine I'm a hired contractor for a non-Jewish person, and he wants me to build his house, right? So would you come up to me and say to me, how come you didn't put an Aron HaKodesh and a mikveh in his basement? He asked me to build his house, so I'm building him the house that he asked me to build. You know? So the reality is that when they hire me, they're not hiring me to be the, you know, the mashgiach, you know. They want me to write jokes and to help the show that they're working on. And I try to meet that responsibility. But at the same time, you know, One of the privileges that I've had personally is breaking stereotypes, you know? People have a lot of stereotypes, and it's crazy because, you know, we say Torat Emet. The Torah is the truth. We say that God looked into the Torah and then created the world. The whole world is made out of the Torah. So there's no reason why people should think that, like, you know, Judaism isn't universal. It's totally universal. So, anyway, go ahead. Well, the center actually in LA is very active. It's very, very active. And, you know, I co-founded a minion in Los Angeles called the Happy Minion of LA. It's sort of the Reb Shlomo Carlebach Minion in LA. And it's thriving right now. It's just jumping. I wish you all could experience the davening there. I'm sure the davening here is great also. But, I mean, people are jumping and singing and dancing, and it's... I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Moshav Band. You know the Moshav Band? So Yehuda Solomon, the lead singer of the Moshav Band, is our chazan. And it's, you know, it's great. I call it, you know, untraditional traditional. You know, because, you know, there's a mechitz and everything like that, but it's just a lot of singing, a lot of joy. Real joy. And one of the things recently that's been happening is there have been a lot of people from the Kabbalah Center that have been coming to us. And so that's a very positive thing. It's a I can tell you that a lot of people start off there and then they go to other places. But it's probably best not to stick around that place. Yeah, go ahead.
Why Orthodoxy?
Say it again?
Why Orthodoxy? What got you out of, or got you thinking outside of the former conservative and stable Orthodoxy?
Okay, so I'll just tell you, I'll just answer in a personal way, a life story way, if that's okay. I remember I was 13, and I was sitting at my, actually in the same seat where I burped. I said to my sister, my older sister, I said, what's the difference between Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox? And she said, well, the Orthodox believe that God gave us the Torah at Mount Sinai. And I said, oh yeah, that's what I am. You know, I never questioned it. I never questioned it. I wasn't brought up that way, but I never questioned it. And I remember, you know, I'll tell you something. Actually, there's a Jewish version of this, but when I heard the initial thing that I told you, I heard it in the name of like a Greek philosopher, which is that, but I'll give you the Jewish version of it in a moment, which is that the sign, or a sign, let's say, a sign that something is true is that after you hear it, it should sound obvious. Okay, so I heard this account, maybe you're familiar with it, I heard in the name of the Brisker Rav, that, you know, he was, as you know, super brilliant and was able to distill tremendously complicated things and then deliver them in a way that people could really understand. And so he once said one of his incredible, you know, distillations, which was, you know, because his brain was the size of a planet, right? And he said it over, and his students said, that's obvious. And he said back to him, was it obvious before I said it? So, anyway, I remember when I was 14, this same neighbor that had sent my brother the Talks and Tales magazine, she sent us to Rabbi Shlomo Carlebach Shul across the street from our house. Siyata Deshamaya, I grew up across the street from his shul, and I started going there when I was 14. I remember dancing with the Torah, Simchas Torah, when I was 14, and feeling like, this is my whole life. This is all I want. This is all I want. And it was just, you know, I didn't go to yeshiva or anything like that, so it's kind of like just baby steps, kind of getting to that place where I finally started keeping Shabbos. I'll tell you one thing, though. I was very, very, very fortunate in that I had set certain goals for myself, and I was able to accomplish them. And the reason why I tell you that is because I was able to see from the standpoint of having gotten what I wanted that those things weren't such big deals. Like, I really wanted to be, I went to Bronx Science. I don't know if you ever heard of Bronx Science. I was the president of the student body at Bronx Science. And I worked very hard to get that position, you know? And once I got it, I was like, okay, this is good, but, you know. And then I really wanted to go to Harvard very, very badly. And I got into Harvard. And I was like, okay, it was great. I had a fantastic time. It was fun. But I was like, and I was like, that's not it, you know? I'll tell you something intense. I spoke at the Harvard Hillel a few years ago, and I told them what I just told you. I said, I got to Harvard, and I said, the truth wasn't here. And someone from the audience said, yes, it is. And I said, no, it isn't. And they said, yes, it is. I said, no, it isn't. I think that was the last time I spoke there. Not by my choice. And then I got out to Hollywood. I really wanted to get a job writing for television. And, you know, thank God I got my first job writing for television when I was 21. And I've been writing pretty much straight for I'm coming up on my 25th year of writing for television. And I got that, and it was like, it was good. I was happy. I was genuinely having fun and enjoying myself. What I'm trying to tell you is that I was able to sort of extrapolate from the standpoint of having these things that I wanted. And looking down saying, okay, this path leads that way. This path leads that way. This path leads that way. I know because I'm there and I can see. And I was like, there's got to be more than this. You know, there's a whole universe that Hashem created. You know, how do you tap into that? You know, Olam HaZeh, not bad. I'm down with Olam HaZeh as much as the next guy. But I'm not a fool. I married a woman who was born and raised in Borough Park, whose father is a rabbi. Should I go on?
Hard being Jewish in Harvard and college in general.
You know what? It was hard. It was hard being Jewish at Harvard, for the reason that for the opposite reason than maybe you're asking. It was hard being Jewish at Harvard because I wasn't being honest with my own soul. In other words, it's not like there's no good kosher restaurants. It's hard. It wasn't hard in that way. It's sort of like, this is cool, but something's off. You know? Yeah.
How did your parents deal with you in college?
You know, at first they were freaked out, honestly. And then they were so proud. They were so proud. And if anyone, I don't know if anyone in this room is going through that, if you're at the parents freaked out stage. But I can tell you that they're going to be very excited about the fact that there's a mitzvah d'oraisa for you to respect them. And they're going to realize that the Torah is actually going to make you a much better son to them. And that will dawn on them, depending on how good a Jew you are, sooner rather than later. And then you'll find that they're going to be very supportive of your Torah. Yeah.
I was wondering, being that you've written for many famous things, have you been able to use that as like an opportunity to do outreach outside of work?
What do you think? now. What's that? Yeah, yeah. Have I done outreach? Yeah, I love speaking to groups. In fact, I give two classes a week in L.A. For about the last 5 years, I give two shiurim a week. And one of them, actually, I send out on the internet. If any of you are interested, I don't know if you guys probably have no time and whatever, I'll just let you know, though, it's there. On 613.org, if you type in SACS, S-A-C-K-S, there's about 100 talks there, and I send out the Sunday talk every week. Here's the thing. Okay, can I give you a mushroom? This is my mushroom. I like this mushroom. I was once watching television, and I saw, it was like a documentary. I tuned in the middle, so I don't know what the documentary was about. But this part that I was watching here, it was about the how people set the table of the Queen of England. Okay? And there's like a small army of workers who put down the plates and all the forks and the spoons and all the different cups and the flower arrangements. But this is what blew my mind. After they did that, they take out a tape measure and they measure the distance between all the different objects to make sure that it's absolutely perfect. Okay? So now, I'm sure all of you have been at some kind of fancy event at some point in your life, or you've heard about it at least, where they like sculpt some of the food, right? You've probably seen that. So imagine you yourself are at one of these banquets with a table that's been set like the way I described it, okay? And you sit down and you take a piece of food that's been sculpted and you taste it and you say the following: I don't like the food, therefore I deny the existence of the caterer. You hear? It's crazy, right? A lot of people, they say, oh, I don't believe in God. Why? Because they've tasted life, and they've seen injustice, and they've seen hatred. But it's anger. It's not disbelief. They don't not believe in God. The proof of God is in front of their eyes every single second. They themselves know that. But they're angry. So much of disbelief is just anger disguised. And people just need to hear things like this. They have souls themselves. They want to do the right thing. And so, you know, you say a good word here, a good word there. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah, go ahead.
How and when did you realize you had this talent of writing?
Okay, so this is kind of a funny story. Yeah, because I was a government major. I thought I was going to go into law or government, you know. And end of freshman year at Harvard, like my friends were, like everyone was doing something fancy, you know. Like they were either working for like a big bank or they were going to like Asia or something. And I didn't have anything to do. So I called up my mom and I said, you know, what am I going to do? And she said, remember I told you we lived at 79th and Broadway. Bless you. She said, I can talk to the superintendent and you could be the elevator man if you like. And I said, all right. So she called me right back. She said, you got the job. I said, yes. So, yeah, and I remember like after the summer was over, like being like a little bit embarrassed about it, you know? So people ask me, so what'd you do over the summer? And I went, traveling. So, I felt like when I got in, I felt like I was the dumbest guy in my whole class. And, you know, and because I really hadn't done much homework and in high school, and I felt like, you know, I was like ashamed to the institution. So I figured, like, I should read all these books that I didn't really actually read. And so on the elevator, I started reading. And I decided, like, you know, since I haven't really read anything, I'll just try to read, like, books that have won the Nobel Prize or the Pulitzer Prize or something like that, you know? So I just started reading, like, I'm not such a fast reader, but as many of the great books that I could read. And while I was reading these books, and by the way, I kept my job as an elevator man all 4 summers, and after I graduated, when I couldn't find a job, I was also the elevator man. So, which was less fun. But I experienced, I guess, what you would call a calling, where I just felt like, I mean, there were times where I'd read sentences that were so beautiful, I'd literally have to put down the book and just catch my breath. And I thought, wow, I'd like to write, you know? And I went into a different kind of writing, but that was kind of when I really felt my creative side, quote unquote, well up, you know? Yeah? At a Jewish singles party in New York. You know? I'd been to a bunch of Jewish singles parties, and from my perspective, they were a tremendous drag, you know? And then I met my wife at one, so there you go. Hishtablis, you know? Amazing, amazing thing. Yeah.
What happened to
Barnard? He has gone on to a fantastic career. He's done great. He's done really great. And I remain truly indebted to him because, like I said, we stayed on that show, and for the next 2-3 years, we wrote together, with me leaving early Friday night and him working Friday night and him really being incredibly supportive, you know? So he was really a hero, as much as he was part of that, the test part of that story. He was really an awesome partner and friend. Yeah. I'm gonna call on you, but just in case anyone hasn't asked a question yet, who might want to ask me? Okay, go ahead. Oh, go ahead.
What did you win your awards for?
I got the Emmy for The Simpsons and the Golden Globe for Third Rock from the Sun. Yeah.
Is that that you made it really something? Is there anybody instrumental on your album?
Yeah, well, was anyone influential in terms of helping me along the Torah path? Yeah, Reb Shlomo Karloff was, when I started going there when I was 14, he became like a father to me. And I was really privileged. He was our Masader Kedushin. And he taught me Torah for like about 18 years. I learned Torah from him. And he never pushed me. He never did anything. He was incredibly loving. All the stories that you hear about what a tzaddik he was and how loving he was and his unconditional love and everything like that, I saw all that firsthand. It's all true. It's all, he was an awesome, 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 awesome individual. And I guess when it came time in my life for me to really commit to it, you know, there it was. You know? But he was there the entire way. Yeah. Yeah. So, how I got involved, I needed a job and they were kind enough to offer one. And why I left, you know, all good things must end.
On the sign that mentioned that you were coming, there was something about Jewish impact films.
Yeah. If you have a chance, we've got some films up, and there's a lot we made that we haven't put up. It's kind of a little bit in a deep freeze right now. We're awaiting some cash. And when I say awaiting, I mean hoping for some cash. it's kind of an expensive program to run, but it's a fantastic program. You can check out the website. It's the way you remember it is GIF, J-I-F. But if you type in GIF, you'll get the peanut butter site. It's JewishImpactFilms.com. So what I wanted to do is I created this fellowship with a couple of people, and we've done four fellowships, actually maybe even five. Two of them have been 3 weeks in L.A., and two of them have been 10-day programs in Jerusalem, where I've got my friends in, you know, high-end people in Hollywood, you know, people with amazing credits, like a dream team kind of thing, and just gotten a group of people together, and, you know, they fly out to Los Angeles, and we just get DV cameras, and we shoot short little guerrilla viral films about funny films about just being Jewish. And it's been great. In fact, our Opus Magnum, which is like about a 2-minute film, which is we haven't put up yet. Look for it. It's called Mezuzah Reloaded. And it's fantastic. It's like all of our ones are here, and this one is like up here. It's amazing. It's like Star Wars. It's live action with high-end computer animation. It's basically about a mezuzah that comes to life and flies around the house like destroying unkosher food. It looks like it cost $1 million to make. I mean, it's really unbelievable. We've been working on it for years, but slowly. So it's about 99% done, so I'm hoping it's going to get on the internet. But when you see it, you'll know it. Go ahead. You know, I always liked the one, it was one of the early ones where Dustin Hoffman plays the teacher. I don't know if you ever saw that one. Yeah, that's a good one. I'll tell you the truth, this is how I was dressed. I've been learning with a rabbi for about, we've been learning together for about 16 years now, and the last 5 years or so since he's moved to Israel, we learn once a week on Sunday mornings, and I told him, he said, well, what do you want to do when you're in Israel? So we had this, I flew in for this wedding yesterday, Mazel Tov. I said, you know, I keep on wanting to get up to Tzfat, you know, and every time I come to Israel the last bunch of times, I've just been in one place, and I want to get to Tzfat. I really want to get there. So my idea was to just kind of, like, go to, like, a couple of gift shops in Tzfat. But I guess what he heard was, let's go to all the kfarim of the tzaddikim. So yesterday it was amazing, actually. Imagine this is a map of Israel right here. So we went from Jerusalem down to, like, the Dead Sea, just like, then we went through Tiberia, up through Maron, to Tzfat, then down the coast of Haifa, then to Beit Shemesh. It was an amazing trip. I saw last night Rabbi David Abu Chasera. Got a brucha from him. That was great. And we went to the kfarim of Rebbe Meir, both shitas. to Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk. What was great about the trip, though? Oh, by the way, you asked me about my T-shirt. I didn't change from yesterday, is the answer. So then we kept on getting lost, and every time we get lost, it would be like another magnificent thing. Like, we got lost, and then there was Rabbi Akiva and the Ramchal. And then we got lost again, and it's like, oh, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. You know, so, you know, if you just tell the story, it's like, oh, yeah, I went to the kever of Rabbi Akiva and the Ramchal. But it wasn't like that. It was sort of like, whoa, where are we? Oh, we're at the kever of Rabbi Akiva and the Ramchal. You know, so the whole thing was like that. And I didn't get to any gift shops in Spot. But I'll tell you one incredibly intense thing. We got to the Ari's, you know, the grave site at after dark. And I was like, aren't you not supposed to go into a cemetery after dark? And he was like, nah, not this one. So all right. So it seems pretty empty, you know. So anyway, went to the Ari's mikveh, and then went to his kever. And I've been there before, once before. But I got to tell you something. This was awesome, because the whole place is black, and you're in the middle of a graveyard, and there's one kever that's lit with fire. It's like on fire from all the candles. And everything else is dark. And if you can picture that in your mind, it was intense. Anyone else? Yeah. Say it again, which one? I don't think I saw that one. All right, we good? Anyone else? Okay. Guys, listen, you know, the truth is that I could talk and talk and talk and talk, but I know you guys had a big trip, and I want to have rachmanis on you. So learn strong, be strong, save the world, and we'll all celebrate together with Mashiach, okay?